This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Giovanna Peebles got the job as Vermont's first state archaeologist, the job had just been created, and Peebles was only 24 years old. So you could say that she and the position grew up together. 38 years later, Peebles is ready to retire. But before she does, we're going to spend some time with her today, talking about Vermont's past and its future. We'll learn a little bit about some of the special projects she's overseen and what she thinks is important work to consider moving forward. If you have questions about Vermont's uncovered past, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or write to us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Giovanna Peebles, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Jane, thanks so much for inviting me today.
Well, we're really pleased to have you here.
And a great treat.
Yeah, it's great to get you before you retire. We wanted to grab you before you left the door.
I'm just sorry you're not in Montpelier with me so you can be holding my hand.
I know, I am too, but I promise this will be an easy exit interview. And our listeners are very kind. So we've got some emails for you already. Let me read you one to get you in the spirit here. We got a note from Karen Meyer who says, "Warm regards and best wishes for success and fun in a new chapter in your extraordinary life. There is way too much for Vermont to thank you for, but I do thank you for taking in my young daughter as an intern and setting her on her path to love and study history and cultures. You made such a difference in her life."
That is so wonderful of Karen to send that in. Thank you, Karen.
Well, let me ask you to take us back, Giovanna Peebles, to 38 years ago. As I said, you were 24 years old. You had just graduated from your master's program. Is that right?
Yes, the master's. Mm-hmm.
In Idaho. Mm-hmm. And you come and apply for the job here in Vermont.
There's actually a funny story around that where on the airplane ride to Vermont, I had one of the books we had been reading in Idaho in the master's program was a book called Public Archaeology. And it had just come out a year or two, and the writer was one of the legends in American archaeology, Chuck McGimsey. And he was just speaking to me. He basically was saying, if you're not doing archaeology for people, with people, why bother? So I walked into my interview with people who then became my dear friends, the earliest team here in the Division for Historic Preservation, and I just said, this is my dream, this is my vision, and everything that Chuck said in his book, that this is what I'm going to do. And 38 years later, it really flew by, Jane. It's pretty crazy.
So obviously,
how time flies.
The officials in Vermont were sold by you saying, this is what it's about, public archaeology for people. But what does that mean? I mean, you know, I think a lot of us think of archaeologists as bending over these test sites and digging or brushing things away, you know, trying to get to the bones with that little brush. So what do you actually see as archaeology for the people?
Well, great question. There's obviously many types of archaeologists, and the people that do the actual work, the hard work, are all my colleagues who work in Vermont who are investigating the sites. They discover the sites as part of investigations resulting maybe from various kind of development projects, and they're the ones who research the sites, do all the hard work in the laboratory, write the reports, the technical reports. So those are the people who, the digging archaeologists, I call them, the ones that have really informed and transformed our knowledge of Vermont history, these colleagues of ours. And what I see myself as public, as the public archaeologist, and maybe arguably this is one of my biggest contributions, is that I have been able to get the word out the same way I'm right now on the radio show with you. I have given hundreds of lectures in these decades, hundreds of workshops, hundreds of in-field visits, walkabouts. I've really promoted that when we discover great things about our history, and we're talking deep time, almost 13,000 years, if we aren't telling the stories, then our work is not relevant or as important. And so one of the things I was able to contribute is when I wrote the archaeology guidelines for the state, From the very beginning, I insisted on a very high level of public outreach. So, and of course, it's commensurate with what's discovered and how much of an impact there is to that site. But we've done some marvelous publications as a result of that. The Velco Vermont Electric Cooperative, working with UVM's consulting archaeology program, did this wonderful book called Powerful History, The Archaeology of Native People in the Champlain Lowlands, and it's online if you Google Powerful History. And that is just an example where I hand it out at workshops, my brochure rack at the New Archaeology Center. And that is one way where we're able to tell everybody what we're learning. And my role has been to say, let's remember to tell everybody what we're learning. Well, I have a Facebook page for archaeology as another example.
Well, plunge us in. I mean, tell us about something that you think Vermonters should know about our heritage that we've discovered through archaeology.
I think, Jane, it's fair to say that archaeology has transformed what we know about Vermont history. And maybe the best example, the best illustration of that is I've just completed this really great timeline at the New Archaeology Center. And there's a number of paintings by this brilliant English archaeologist that does a lot of work in Vermont. Her name is Gemma Hudgel. And she painted all these scenes to remind us that archaeology at the end of the day is about people. We might be recovering many kinds of data sets like artifacts, you know, investigating cultural features like house floors and within fire hearths. We have seeds and animal bones and fish bones, but it's all about people. And so this timeline, Jane, we just completed there on the second floor of the History Center in Barrie really illustrates everything we've learned. For example, 38 years ago, there was one Paleo-Indian site known from Vermont, and the Paleo people were the very first people that settled in our state. And we were thinking that the sites dated maybe to 10,000 years, 10,500 years ago. But in the last decade, there's been this explosion of knowledge by the working archaeologists who have discovered several dozen Paleo-Indian sites here in Vermont. And based on analysis of other sites across the greater Northeast, based on work done by the geologists at Middlebury College and UVM, we're dating our first sites in Vermont to 12,500 years ago. Hmm. And this is all absolutely brand new. And we're also learning for the first time that the Champlain Sea, now, none of us learned this in school, but many of us at this point know that before Lake Champlain was our freshwater lake, it had been a marine sea, an arm of the Atlantic Ocean after deglaciation. And so from 13,000 years ago about to 9,700 years ago, we had this marine sea. And we've just recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, understood that the first people of Vermont were here at the same time as the Champlain Sea. Hmm. So it's just one little example where we're just exploding our knowledge. And if you look at the timeline when you all come to visit the Archaeology Center, it's this 25-foot wall. And for the greatest part of that history, it is the native history of Vermont. It's about the native peoples, how they adapted, how they changed, how they kept it going mm-hmm. for adapted 500 generations of continuity, change, and adaptation is what
wow.
we call it.
Well, and I understand when you got started, there was debate about whether or not Native Americans had actually even had civilizations and communities here in Vermont, and you were partly responsible for trying to make sure that we knew what really happened.
Well, what's interesting is any of us as kids, and I started school in Vermont in eighth grade, but even my oldest son, who's in his 40s now, we learned the Indians never lived here. They were just passing through. Now, of course, the Abnakis knew differently, and the other group who knew differently were the arrowhead collectors and the antiquarian the early antiquarians who were collecting artifacts on every open field in Vermont. So between the collectors who were collecting the material culture of these ancient communities and the contemporary Abnaki, who've always known they were here, what we needed to do was sort of make this enormous – bridge this enormous gap in information. And now we have thousands of native sites we've discovered, village sites, quarries up on top of the Green Mountains, farming sites. We've radiocarbon dated our earliest farming sites to 1100 AD. We have them in Swanton. We have them in Springfield, the Burlington Intervale. We knew none of this. And then on the underwater, of course, in 1978, I saw an article in the Burlington Free Press that a gentleman named Arthur Cohn had recovered a cannonball from the lake. And that started our remarkable relationship with the underwater sites, where we opened together the first underwater parks in the country in 1985, the first underwater historic preserve ever. We testified on the abandoned shipwreck bill in Congress in 1987. We had this amazing little group called the Champlain Maritime Society, where I was able to give them $250,000 worth of federal grants. And then in the late 80s, of course, Art and Bobby Beach started the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum there at Basin Harbor, and they have been ongoing, fantastic partners on the underwater side. And we knew nothing, for all intents, about Lake Champlain maritime history. We learned about the canal boats that were unique to Lake Champlain. We learned about the horse ferry, of which there were many across the country, but ours was the only one known as a shipwreck. We learned about the French and Indian War and the War of 1812. And so we have lots of books to write. I might end up editing, you know, soliciting authors after I retire. And there's just so much we've learned.
Well, it's so exciting to be able to hear your enthusiasm for our past and to learn a little bit about Vermont archaeology. I suppose geology comes into play as well, but archaeology.
Definitely that.
We're talking with Giovanna Peebles. She's been the state archaeologist for the last 38 years, and we're catching her just before she retires. Listeners, if you have questions for her about Vermont's past, call 1-800-639-2211 or send a note to vermontedition@vpr.net. We'll be right back. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're joined by Vermont's state archaeologist, Giovanna Peebles. She's retiring a week from today, and we're getting her expertise before she goes on what we can learn about Vermont's past through its archaeology. We're also going to talk about a state archaeology heritage center in Barrie that Giovanna Peebles is very excited about. She had a hand in creating it. And listeners, if you have questions about Vermont's uncovered past, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Giovanna, you mentioned a few minutes ago Vermont arrowhead collectors and how they had been discovering things before there was a state archaeologist. And let me read you a couple of emails that we got that are sort of taking off from that point. Doug in Underhill says, I have a question or suggestion about citizen scientists. In the 1950s and 60s, I spent many hours with my dad walking the plowed fields of western Vermont looking for artifacts. His large collection made its way to UVM, and he became an early member of the Vermont Archaeology Society. I have often wanted to return to looking for surface materials, but have resisted the urge because of concerns about archaeological etiquette. I wonder if a program could be developed where interested volunteers could be certified to perform such a service. And similarly, Bart says, what opportunities exist for amateur resident archaeologists? Is there any assistance available to those who own historic properties for assistance in investigating their properties thoughtfully? What do you think about that? Citizen archaeologists and the role of people in helping to uncover our past.
Well, I love that word, citizen scientist. One of the dilemmas that we have always had in Vermont is that there's just so few of us, and I have a huge amount of energy, but it only goes so far. And the working archaeologists, of course, a lot of times they're under contract to a developer, they're on a tight time schedule, So in the course of a day-to-day, they might not always be able to bring volunteers onto their teams, although when they can, they definitely do. The Vermont Archaeological Society, they have professional archaeologists working with them, but a lot of times they don't necessarily want to give up their Saturdays or Sundays also. And the fact that UVM and none of the Vermont colleges and universities have a master's or PhD program in archaeology, actually in anthropology with a concentration in archaeology, this capacity is a real obstacle to this dream of citizen scientists. But with that said, I think that I would love to see nothing but the new state archaeologist think about doing a certification program. They've had programs like that, BART, in Arkansas and other states, New Hampshire. And I think we just need to organize, because I know that there's so much talent out there. People love history. I see that in metal detectorists. There is a shared passion in learning about history, but there just needs to be more collaboration, more training, because I think certainly people can learn from each other. Our citizen scientists can learn from the archaeologists, but the archaeologists can learn from the citizen scientist, who might be a videographer, he might be a photographer, might be whatever.
So what if you're kicking around in your backyard or in your fields, as one of our listeners mentioned, and you find an arrowhead or you find something that you think may have been from early European civilizations? Are you allowed to take that and keep it as your own?
Well, on your land, you can do anything you want. This is America, after all. The only types of resources protected on the only types of cultural resources protected on private land are burial sites. So under state statute, it is against the law to disturb any unmarked burial or burial site, whether it's on your land or my land or on public land. But short of the burials, if there is a village site in your backyard, people can excavate it and put a new swimming pool in it. They can do anything they want. Now, most Vermonters are very, just like the first gentleman said, he doesn't want to disturb the site. And I would certainly encourage him to join the Vermont Archaeological Society. There's a wonderful group of people. And Jane, the Vermont Archaeological Society is one of the oldest nonprofits in all of Vermont, starting in the mid-60s. They are a small nonprofit. They have no paid staff. They have no administrative people. They're just volunteers. But if you Google Vermont Archaeological Society, that will pop up. And they have meetings several times a year, and they organize excavations. They just did one at Warren Falls down in Warren. They did it last year as well. And so it's a great group, and I would start there.
Well, and in fact, Doug, who wrote to us about not wanting to disturb the site, said his father actually became one of the earliest members. He was doing that work in
What's
the 50s
Doug's
and 60s.
Last name, if I can ask?
I don't know. We only give first name, but I can send it to you. I'm sure he wouldn't mind having it sent to you, Giovanna. So I'll do that after the show. But Giovanna, we have a lot of callers actually who want to get in and ask you questions. Yeah, people, as you said, are fascinated by Vermont history. So let's take a couple of them. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling in from Sharon. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a question about Indian caves, or are they Viking caves by the Nordics? Not sure which is what. I've been given both stories.
Yeah, well, Jennifer, let's go to the source. Giovanna, Indian caves or Viking caves? We got another note about this,
Sharon,
from
hi.
Jackson.
Thank you for calling in. In 1976, when I walked into the Pavilion office building, which is where our offices were then on the fourth floor, there was a file folder on my desk and only one file folder. And my boss said, I want you to find out what these stone chambers are, because I'm getting a lot of questions and we need to know if they belong to the historic period. Are they ancient? Are they worth preserving? What are they? So, Sharon, in 1977, amongst other intense field projects, I embarked on a survey of all Vermont stone chambers. I actually was able to hire two people to help me. We did deed research on every single property. We did title searches. We did historic research in every community. And I ended up writing a book called Vermont's Stone Chambers, An Inquiry into Their Past. And it's actually online on our website. The best way to do it is to Google it, Vermont's Stone Chambers, An Inquiry into Their Past. And
don't leave us hanging, though. What are so, Native American Vikings? Come on.
No, they are the vast majority of the stone chambers in Vermont, and most of them tend to be on the eastern side of the state, coincident with a particular type of limestone that makes for easy construction of these masonry, just remarkably beautiful vernacular structures. Most of them are historic period. They date between probably 1800 and pre-Civil War. And I arguably got a PhD dissertation level experience in researching and writing the book I did. There's hundreds of footnotes, which are arguably better than the book itself. And what we learned is that there was a tremendous amount of root cultivation in Vermont, like rutabagas, turnips, and that the number one crop for Vermont's animals, sheep, cattle, were roots up until about the Civil War. And there was a tremendous need to store all these root crops. And these stone chambers are remarkable where they're just like your cellar, like a serious root cellar, where the temperature never moves much beyond about 55 or 56 degrees. So even in the dead of winter, it's 55 or 56 degrees, and in the summer. And I did cross-cultural research from Iceland to England to across the greater Northeast, and there was all kinds of convincing evidence. There was a number of archaeological excavations on some of the chambers. The only things discovered were 19th-century materials. And until someone comes up with brand-new research and evidence to the contrary, that's the party line from our end.
Wow. So early root cellars. That's fascinating. Let's go to Scott calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question. The petroglyphs in Bell's Falls, which were incised by the Daughters of the American Revolution and made deeper, and they have all these different faces.
Yeah.
Some with antlers and stuff that are carved into the rock, and it's a spot right now where they've been disputing the ownership of the bridge.
Yes.
Between New Hampshire and Vermont. And, you know, there's been rocks dumped on it, on the petroglyphs. There's been trash dumped on the path in the previous years, and a lot of the people in Bellows Falls don't even know that they exist. And I love to go there because I think it's one of the most amazing things to see.
They are.
In southern Vermont, you know, one of the rare examples of really amazing petroglyphs in the Northeast.
So you'd like to see them better preserved, Scott?
The state hasn't done something to make that into a some sort of small archaeological site for the public to visit with a path and some stairs and something, you know, protection of the actual site.
Yeah, Scott, let's give that to Giovanna Peebles.
Great, great questions and great observations, Scott. I am very familiar with the Bellows Falls petroglyphs, and petroglyphs are rock carvings. And as Scott has so well stated, they were recarved multiple times in the 20th century, and rock riprap was dumped on it to shore up the railroad bed, and all kind of ignominious things have happened to the petroglyphs. There was a time when I did work with the community, and we had an engineering study to create an overlook on the Vilas Bridge there. The petroglyphs are really sacred to the Abnaki community, and I'm not sure, I've never asked them, but I don't know how the Abnakis would feel about a more intrusive kind of a viewing environment. It is, I don't know that we can – I think we can make people much more aware of their significance. I do know that the Agency of Transportation, who's a very close partner of ours and our Division for Historic Preservation, everybody is very, very cognizant to care for the petroglyphs as the bridge project hopefully moves ahead. And we have done talks. Scott, I don't know if you've ever picked up any of the programs, but during Archaeology Month, several times – Archaeology Month is every September – and you should Google Vermont Archaeology Month and keep an eye on it because we have amazing programs throughout the month. So we've done some programs, Scott, on the petroglyphs, very well attended. And I actually have an inventory of all of Vermont's petroglyphs. And compared to the western states, where, of course, there's no trees, there's thousands of petroglyphs out west, thousands of pictographs, which are paintings and carvings. There's very few in Vermont. And my theory, Scott, is that there were so many trees that the native peoples did not need to carve in stone for commemorative reasons or sacred reasons. And then the other famous petroglyph, Scott, is down in your neck of the woods. Of course, you know that under on the West River. There's the petroglyphs that were flooded by the Vernon Dam.
Hmm.
And you're familiar with those, Scott?
I think there's actually one more down in Guilford on the
Guilford, on that appears to be an 18th or 19th century, maybe early 19th century petroglyph. Familiar with that. Really interesting. But they're very special in Vermont, and they're a favorite resource of mine, a favorite site. And I'm hearing what you're saying, and if there's things that we can do to improve the situation, I think we should.
Well, Siobhana, let me ask you. You know, you mentioned that you're very aware of these petroglyphs, and there are some questions because these are a very special Native American site, very special to the Abnakis, and so there's some question about whether it would be too intrusive to have them be a state site and available to people to come and see. So how do you –
Well, there's also a safety issue. I've been at that site dozens and dozens of times, and at high water, the high water there below the Bellows Falls station at the dam is really intense.
Huh.
If you've never seen the high water – whipping through there, it's a sight to see.
Well, but both of those things, though,
there's a lot of issues.
Yeah. So when you have issues like that, and when some of them are cultural sensitivities, how do you walk that line when you know that there are historical sites of great importance to our state and to our history? How do you then determine what the role of state government is in preserving them and making them accessible to the public?
Well, great question. And I always go back to talk to people, collaboration, bring everyone together, bring the community together, the landowner. I think USGen or TransCanada, I think, owns the petroglyphs legally. Bring in the Abnaki community, bring in the transportation agency, of course, because this is quite close to their right-of-way there. Maybe bring in the railroad people. So bring in all the interested parties and get their perspectives, their concerns, their opportunities. What do we all think should happen? And that would be the first step. That's what I do. That's what we always do when we have a contentious issue or changes or differences of opinion, costs involved. There's a lot. But my party, from the beginning of time, you know, I just bring the people together and say, let's figure this out. What can we figure it out? Can we find some accommodation or not?
Giovanna, we got a note, a call in from your son, Cam, who just wanted to say that in addition to being the best archaeologist, you're also the best mother in the world. And I'm hoping maybe you can embarrass Cam, because I understand you raised four children while also having this job. So did they traipse around these sites and stumble over things that you were hoping would be better preserved but now have little kid footprints all over
that
them?
That is really funny. So I'm going to embarrass Cam right back and say he's our baby at age 26. He is at the University of Texas, Austin, getting his PhD in organic chemistry, which is a total mystery what he's researching. But Cameron, two of the four kids, did not participate in archaeology, but both Josh and Skye have done a lot of archaeology. In fact, Josh was a double major in archaeology and geology at Hamilton College and decided, Mom, I don't want to be poor like you. I think I'm going to go into geology. And he ended up going into environmental kind of studies. And Sky had no interest whatsoever. She was an African studies person. And I insisted she take a six-week field school in Elko, Nevada, which I encouraged every one of my young mentees. I said, do an archaeology field school out west. It's a great opportunity to see the west, live in a tent, you know, travel a little bit, learn a little bit about archaeology. So it's been a privilege of my life to have had this job and have the most amazing husband and four kids. And somehow we pulled it off.
Let me ask you, though, if you can fix something before you leave. You have a week left in this job, and I want you to get some consistency here in the spelling of archaeology and archaeologist. Is there an A or not? Because I was looking all over the state websites this morning, and there's no consistency. Sometimes it's archaeology, and sometimes it's just archaeology. Can you fix that, Giovanna?
That is very funny, because I have promised my boss over 2 years ago that I was working on fixing that, and obviously have not succeeded. But both spellings are completely proper. And when I started the job 38 years ago, I said, you know, people have a hard enough time even thinking about archaeology, much less spelling it. So let's drop that second A. So the public archaeologists in the federal government and most state government have dropped that second A. The academics and the historians always kept it. So archaeology with the two A's has always been in the academy you go to. So when they write, they're always writing with that second A. When I was writing, I was always dropping the A. And so sometimes I would make fun of ourselves and say, who's right? I'd say, we're both right. Everybody's right. But I have switched over to the second A just because I was obviously in the minority after 38 years. And so when we opened the new archaeology center in Barrie, I did my friends a favor and added that second A, and it took me a good 9 months to change how I wrote that word.
Well, I was going to say, because I noticed that the Vermont Archaeology Heritage Center in Barrie, which you are justifiably proud of and had a big hand in, has the second A. So if people go there, what are they going to see?
If people go there, they are going to see two wonderful exhibits. One is called How Do You Know That? And it explains through this 4,000-year-old village in Bennington, how do we know it's a site? How do we know it's a tool? How do you know it's a cultural feature? And then this timeline I was explaining earlier is just a great overview of our 13,000 years of history. And then there's a 500-year-old dugout, and there's lots of free publications. And when the state archaeologist is in office there twice a week, they can tell stories. You can share information with them. And we do education programs there. And, of course, in September, we will be doing Archaeology Month again. And keep an eye out for Archaeology Month programs, doing a great conference on September 26th on the War of 1812 in Burlington. We'll give credits for educators. And it's been a privilege of my life to have done this job.
Well, Giovanna Peebles may be retiring as state archaeologist a week from today, but clearly your enthusiasm for the work that you have been doing carries on. We really appreciate you being on the program today, Giovanna, and good luck.
Jane, thank you so much. We'll see each other again.
Absolutely.
In new hats.
That's right. Coming up, why Karl Rove's Super PAC has gotten involved in a congressional primary fight in upstate New York. Voters there go to the polls tomorrow. We'll find out about it next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermonters don't go to the polls until August, but tomorrow, primary voters in New York will have their say as to who makes it to the general election in November. One particularly contentious race is in the 21st Congressional District. This district covers parts of 12 counties and includes the cities of Plattsburgh, Glens Falls, and Watertown. And the race of interest is between Republicans Elise Stefanik and Matt Doheny. Joining us to explain why this race has caught the interest of outside interests is Harvey Shantz, chairman of the Political Science Department at SUNY Plattsburgh. Professor Shantz, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. This is the second time I've been on. Last time was in 2009 when this race was first on the national radar.
Yeah, that's right. And remind us of why that was on the national radar and where things stand now, because Doheny's been a player now for a few elections as well.
Well, what happened in 2009 was our longtime congressman, John McHugh, was tapped by President Obama to become Secretary of the Army. And this caused a vacancy in this House seat. And people who follow the demographics had noticed that we were voting for Democrats in many of the races, such as President and U.S. Senate. And when our Republican congressman vacated, the Democrats felt they had a nice chance of, for the first time in a century, of winning this district. And indeed, the Democrats have won the district for three straight elections, in the special election of 2009, and in 2010 and 2012. And each time, Bill Owens was the winning Democratic candidate. But as you know, he said he was going to retire this January.
Right. So there's an open seat. And before we get into the particulars of the Republicans running for this open seat, let's play an ad for our listeners. This has been running in the Watertown, Albany, and the Burlington-Plattsburgh markets. And let's listen to what it's been saying.
Multimillionaire Matt Doheny just doesn't learn from his mistakes. Maybe that's why Doheny's already lost three elections for Congress. The Daily Times reported Doheny is a significantly flawed candidate. Doheny was sued twice for not paying rent on his New York City apartments, charged twice for boating under the influence, then violated multiple labor laws. Matt Doheny? It would be a big mistake to send him to Congress. American Crossroads is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Okay, so as we heard at the end of the ad there, that is not an ad from challenger Ann Stefanik. It is from Matt Doheny, who's also a Republican challenger. As we said, this is an open seat, so they're both challenging here. And we heard right at the end of that ad, American Crossroads is responsible for the content of this advertising. That's the super PAC that was started by Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie, and it has never before gotten involved in a House primary. But it's spent about $250,000 on this one in ad buys. So why is American Crossroads inserting itself into this race, Harvey Shantz?
Well, they might be interested in the person who's running for the race, Elise Stefanik. For example, Elise Stefanik is tied to working for President George W. Bush, and obviously Karl Rove was the mastermind behind George W. Bush winning the presidency. So you can look at it from that point of view, that she's familiar with the players who are in that super PAC. Also, they may have a concern over getting who they perceive to be the better candidate nominated so that their party can win this very rare toss-up congressional district.
Matt Doheny has been involved in the last two elections and lost both times to Bill Owens. But now that Bill Owens is out of the race, I guess that would leave an opening for Matt Doheny. Is he not a viable candidate?
Well, he is a viable candidate, but a number of factors impinge on this. One is that after you lose two races, people start to perceive that maybe you cannot win the election. And second is, he was really tired of running after he lost the second time in 2012, and he did not want to go debate Bill Owens again. And so he had vacated. And before Bill Owens had said that he was going to retire in January of 2014, Elise Stefanik had announced for the race. So Elise Stefanik was laying down a campaign, and she also went to each of the county party organizations in the district, of which there are 12. And she won the endorsement from 11 of the 12 party district organizations. The only one that didn't endorse her was from Doheny's home district of Jefferson County. But Doheny felt that he really should run again because he had struggled twice and he had great name recognition. And so he did not bother to court the party organizations across the district, which is a large district. The district, you have to understand, is over 16,000 square miles, which makes it a district that's larger than the state of Vermont. So it's a huge district, but he felt that he should get the nomination. After all, he was running against the incumbent. So he got off to a slow start, and she was able to win some organizational support.
Both of these candidates, though, will be on the ballot regardless of who wins the primary, because Doheny is on the independence line. Stefanik is on the Conservative Party's choice in November. So is there still going to be a fight no matter who wins tomorrow?
That's a problem for the Republicans, both statewide and in a congressional district. Generally, New York State is just about the only state. It's the only state that uses this widely, what's called cross-filing, where candidates are able to run on the ticket of or on the line of more than one party. So each of the candidates now has a minor party that they're affiliated with, and the Democrats haven't had that problem in this district, as the Working Families Party has endorsed the Democratic candidate. So a problem for the Republicans is that the Conservative Party and the Independence Party have already endorsed different candidates in this district. So most likely the candidate will be on the ticket. Now, a candidate can get off the ticket if they get a judicial nomination. So, for example, in 2010, Rick Lazio got a judicial appointment so he can get off the Conservative Party ballot in the election of 2010 after he lost the primary to Palladino.
But so we're going to have to see what happens then in this one. Sorry to cut you off there, Professor Shantz, but that's all the time we have for this today. But as you said, ongoing issues here. We're going to have to wait and see what happens in November. First, the primary for New York voters tomorrow. We've been talking about one of the congressional districts where there's a big fight in the Republican primary. Harvey Shantz has been telling us about it. He's a chairman of the Political Science Department at SUNY Plattsburgh. Thanks very much, Professor Shantz.
Thank you for this opportunity.
For some people, the idea of singing in public is out of the question. But for others, karaoke is a weekend ritual. For today's installment of Vermont Edition's Summer School, we're going to get some pointers from an expert who says anyone can be a karaoke star, even if you don't have a great voice.
My name is Mackenzie Siverett. I have competed in two different karaoke competitions. Time that you put yourself in front of an audience alone, it is always nerve-wracking. But what I found to be helpful in the beginning is going to different places that offer karaoke with friends and kind of observing the environment. If you're not really a singer and you have it in your head that you want to do karaoke, start thinking about what song you would want to sing before you get to the karaoke bar. Think about whose voice, like what artist's voice, seems similar to yours. Come on, come on, baby. Try to find something that you think people would respond to, a song that people also know. I feel like Britney Spears is a good like intro. Yeah, Hit Me Baby One More Time. Like a classic pop song that's short, sweet, fun, is good for, you know, a group of girls or a girl who's singing for the first time. And I've found in Vermont that a lot of country goes over well, up-tempo country songs. Whether you're a good singer or not, you want people to be responding to you one way or another. Stage presence is arguably more important in karaoke than singing itself. And I know that for a lot of people, the singing part of karaoke is what stops them. I've seen the crowd respond to people who were not great singers, who owned the stage, really captivated the audience, even pass somebody the mic so they can sing a few seconds of a song. I mean, those are the kind of things that get people who are watching really excited. I would say selecting a short song is definitely a better idea for somebody versus a long song, because the less time that you have to keep somebody's attention, you know, the more captivated and involved they're going to be in the performance.
VPR's Annie Russell produced that lesson in how to sing karaoke. That'll do it for today. Tomorrow, we tend to think about Vermont agriculture in terms of grow local, buy local, eat local. But we'll learn about a sector of the state's agriculture industry that focuses on sending products far away, like China. That's tomorrow on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.